This is the United States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Chris Stafford. On the show this week, Jeremy Steinberg will be joining us with a training tip, and we continue with part three of the series by Dr. Kent Allen on understanding the USEF FEI medication rules. But we begin with news that the On the Levels Trainers Tips and Commentary, which is also available on DVD through the USDF online store, has a preview on eTrack of the new content that includes a judge's commentary and is now available on onthelevels.com through a yearly subscription. And there's also an app for iOS and Android devices. You can sign in or subscribe to see the new content that's available online by going to onthelevels.com, and there'll be a link in our show notes. And now, California-based trainer and clinician Jeremy Steinberg has our training tip this week on sitting the trot.
You know, one of the biggest things I think with learning the sitting trot is, you know, if it's something, whether it's something you've struggled with or are struggling with, or something that you're kind of new to doing, along with, you know, even if you're an advanced rider, there's definitely some things to, you know, constantly keep in mind. I think for the kind of beginning rider or riders that are, you know, just struggling a bit with really getting kind of a good groove going with the sitting trot, I think the biggest thing to really keep in mind is to first start with the horse that is relatively easy to sit and not, you know, bite off more than you can chew right at the beginning. I think one of the biggest things, you know, with the sitting trot is we have, especially with the dressage horses, pretty big moving horses these days, and everybody wants a big moving horse. And it seems like kind of a daunting feat, I think, to first kind of look at that and think, how am I ever going to be able to sit it? And, you know, once you kind of start to get a feel for it and a groove for it, it actually, you know, starts to kind of swing and work through your body fairly easily. Regardless of, you know, whether the horse is a big mover or a small mover, but definitely kind of looking to start with something that's easy to sit on to start, I think, is the way to go. One of the big things I'm always telling people when they're learning how to do it, you know, or struggling with it along those lines of keeping it easy, is to make sure the horse itself is one that we can kind of adjust and play with, whether it's the trainer on the ground or the rider sitting on, that we could adjust or play with them, and the horse itself not really take advantage or kind of go to a negative spot based on that. And kind of what I mean by it is I tend with a lot of my riders with the trot itself to start with the horse trotting fairly slow, you know, that it's not a really fast trot or a really a lot of momentum or a really bouncy trot to begin with. And I just worry with some of the horses, if I start them out too slow, that they might take advantage later and not want to kind of get moving and get going again. So I think that's really important to have one just of kind of good minds to work in that way. I think one of the best places to start when it comes to sitting trot is really on a lunge line in a controlled environment, horse with side reins on, that's safe, and a really good person on the ground to kind of help not just lead the rider, but help keep the horse safe and doing what they should be doing. I think the biggest thing with that, with working on the ground with them or working on the lunge line, is a lot of times, you know, especially I think, at least in the States, you know, I find a lot of people don't want to take that time and put that energy in, whether it's the trainers that don't want to bother doing it, or it's the rider themselves that kind of want more instant gratification type feel when they ride. And it's really imperative and really worth it to take that time to be lunged, where you don't have to worry about having the reins, you don't have to worry about stirrups, you don't have to worry about the steering and keeping the horse on the bit and all of that, because it can really add a lot to the equation as far as variables go when you're focusing on developing, you know, an independent seat and a real follow with the horse's back. I think one of the big things too to keep in mind with sitting trot work, you know, is a lot of people will do work outside or off the horses, gym work, cardiovascular work, strength-filled work, and all of that. And I think, you know, I am always encouraging my own riders and students to definitely do that, be fit, you know, stretch, be loose, work on your core. But I think in the end, you know, sitting on a horse itself and kind of working the muscle groups that are involved with actually being on a horse isn't something you can really reproduce somewhere else when it comes to kind of any other type of activity. And I think the reason being just the horses themselves kind of activate a little bit of your cardiovascular system, but also there's a lot of stabilization muscles that are used through your core and your arms, your back, your shoulders, your legs, and kind of uniting all of those muscles to work together is something that's really hard to recreate off of a horse. So you can do a lot outside the horses to get yourself fit and strong and loose and stretched, but nothing will really mimic or recreate, you know, what you're doing on a horse better than actually just being on a horse. I tell people that all the time, that the best, you know, gym for riding muscles is really on the back of a horse to kind of work that development. I think, you know, when it comes to that sitting trot work and being on the horses' backs themselves, I think one of the big key players is just the actual swing feel that the trot starts to develop, and the swing feel, you know, through your hips and through your seat, and really allowing kind of your seat to find that kind of up and down, back to front kind of swing, and almost, I think, sometimes flick in your lower back where, you know, your abs kind of tighten and you pull your hips forward, keeping your spine fairly upright. But like I said, one of the best starting points is kind of sitting on a horse that's fairly slow moving in the trot to just really let yourself be able to relax and not, you know, try to kind of bite off more than you can chew all at once. I think another big part, too, of sitting the trot is, you know, like I was saying, the bigger moving horses versus a lesser moving horse. The bigger moving horses aren't always necessarily harder to sit on based on the size of the stride or their movement. Sometimes the small horses can be quite bouncy and jarring. Sometimes if the horse is a little bit out behind, has upright pasterns, has a pretty upright shoulder, those are things that can all kind of combine together as well to make horses kind of bouncier or harder to sit on. So one of the most important factors is the trueness of the horse, where if they're not quite round and not really through in the way that they need to be carrying themselves, it can create a bit of a trampoline-like action to the back, which adds a lot of spring and a lot of kind of shock that travels upward and has to be absorbed by the rider. So the roundness and the trueness become extremely important when it comes to kind of finding a nice feel in the horse's back. When we kind of look at the back of the horse directly, in the sitting trot itself, there is a bit of up and down movement of just kind of the rise and fall of the horse coming up off the ground as it leaves the ground and has that moment of suspension. But when you actually look at the back itself, is a, you know, you could look at it kind of, you know, like a wire or a tightrope basically that's strung between the croup of the horse and the wither of the horse, where you're actually sitting. And if you watch that wire as the horse is leaving the ground and landing on the ground, that wire or that string of muscles, basically the spine, doesn't actually have a lot of up and down movement to it. The horse has a lot of up and down movement, but it's its whole body kind of leaving the ground. So when the horses aren't quite round enough or through enough, that wire gets a bit too much of a sag to it, which can then create more and more of that trampoline-like action where you get a lot of spring back on the back, and that can add a lot to kind of the balance and the difficulty of sitting the trot. So the roundness is really key with that. I think as a general rule, you know, even as an advanced rider, there's always, you can't in and of itself really do too much work without stirrups when it comes to kind of working the sitting trot. I'm big on that myself, both with my students, young ones, older ones, amateur riders, professional riders, and myself, so going, you know, once a week or once every other week with the more advanced riders, even still checking in, you know, a day or so of riding without stirrups to really make sure that your center of gravity is as deep as you can get it, your leg is as long as you can get it, and you really do still have that nice independence from the stirrup itself. When it comes to sitting on the horse's back, you know, a more advanced rider, a more beginner rider, the big thing to really keep in mind is the lower your center of gravity gets, the deeper feeling you start to get into a horse's back, which is
why it's important as a dressage rider to ride with a relatively long stirrup iron or stirrup leather. I think the key with that is to go, you know, not too long where you're reaching for the stirrup and end up struggling a bit to actually make contact with your foot in the stirrup. You still want to be able to keep your heel down. You want to still have a bend in your knee where you can have a nice alignment of, you know, a hip to heel and ear angle that ends up being perpendicular to the ground. But you do want to have a relatively long stirrup that allows a real sinking down of your weight. I think if they get too long and we start to reach a little bit with our toes for the stirrup iron, our muscles tend to be contracting versus stretching, which can tighten, you know, our thighs, our hamstrings a bit, and kind of literally our butt in the saddle, and actually give us a little more lift upward out of the saddle, which is, you know, not ideal and not what we want. So we do want to have a stirrup where your leg can kind of drape down the horse's side, but still has a little bit of weight or enough weight in the stirrup iron itself to give your calf a bit of a downward stretch to be able to just push slightly down into the stirrup so that you're actively lengthening the leg versus reaching for the stirrup where you might inadvertently be contracting those muscles. Same goes for the shoulders and the arms, you know, in your head is thinking, I always think in my spine of having somebody pull just straight upward on my helmet, where I would feel that little bit of pressure under my chin on the harness itself pulling upward to elongate my spine. And with that nice long spine, I'm always thinking of my shoulders being really down, trying to reach my elbows down toward my hips. So I'm trying to stretch my body tall, but still pull my weight down toward the saddle so that I get that nice kind of lowering and sinking feel with my center of gravity. The deeper your center of gravity can be, the lower it can start to feel, the closer and closer and closer it gets to the horse's center of gravity, which just allows for kind of smoother transition of energy between, you know, rider and horse. So the deeper we learn to sit, which is where that work without stirrups becomes really important, that we get that nice long pull to the leg and real deep seated feel in the saddle, the deeper we can start to sit, the easier and easier that starts to get as well. I think, you know, it's important to keep in mind a well-fitting saddle that's neither, you know, too big or too small, because if you start to get pushed into the wrong part of the saddle with your seat, if you don't have enough support, you'll end up swimming. If you have a little too much support where the pommel or the cantle will end up being a little too high and a little too forceful, your hips aren't actually allowed to find kind of the swing motion that they need to find. So the ideal fitting saddle is really important to keep in mind as well. One note with that I always like to just bring up is some of the longer-legged riders, riders with a longer femur, tend to need a bit of a saddle that's a little bigger than their actual seat size to allow for room for that long femur to be able to hang without feeling like it's kind of wedged or pushed too tightly up into the knee roll. So that's just an important one to kind of keep in the back of your mind. But yeah, I think to work without stirrups is the way to really go, because it allows that real sinking into the center of the saddle. Big part of that is to make sure as well that you're not sitting kind of back and down onto kind of the meaty part of your butt, that your butt itself isn't really touching or bumping into the cantle of the saddle, that we stay really nice and more or less upright on our seat bones. So we can really allow a flexion to our hip to happen with the forward swing of the horse. I think if we get a little too far kind of into the back of the saddle and or our seat starts to sit more onto the cantle of the saddle, we end up kind of a little slouched to our lower back, bringing our shoulders kind of rounded and forward and not tall and long, kind of bringing the seat bones up into the middle part of the saddle and allowing that real kind of sinking feel and long, deep draping feel around the horse's side. But yeah, I think when it comes to the sitting trot, the most important thing you can do, the best thing you can do is get on the lunge line, spend some time without stirrups, take your time kind of getting to feel just that very slow onset of the trot coming in and build up to a bigger and bigger and bigger trot as you go with your training.
And you can learn more about this topic in a corresponding article published in the September issue of the USDF Connection magazine. And now Dr. Kent Allen joins us again for part 3 of the short series on understanding the USEF FEI medication rules. These audio excerpts are taken from the Riding with a Vet DVDs, which you can find on the USDF online store.
So let's talk about USDF permitted, okay? And we'll ask you the same question here. What's different from FEI? So all nutrients, vitamins, minerals, electrolytes, fluids. Now, USDF here we're talking about. Most hormonal products used for a therapeutic reason, and example here is Resumate or Altrinogest, and must be a legitimate therapeutic use. So, how would I change this to make it correct for FEI? The answer is, you just simply line out most hormonal products used for therapeutic purposes, leave Resumate, okay, which is legal under FEI Form 2. All the other nutrients, vitamins, electrolytes, not a problem. And then, obviously, it's a legitimate therapeutic use, which means, as is true in all of it, is Resumate can only be used in mares, right? That does not have a legitimate therapeutic use in geldings or stallions. Okay, so forbidden substances, and there's a whole bunch of these, and these are the ones that would affect performance, okay? Interfere with testing, yes, that's a category that we have always left there for years and years and years, but there are few drugs in this category. We talk about Lasix, but again, the testing nowadays is fairly sophisticated equipment, okay? And so Lasix, when we had much less sophisticated equipment, Lasix could affect it. Nowadays, the USEF drug testing veterinarian, they're standing there with your horse for a half an hour and it hadn't produced any urine, they'll suggest to you, hey, why don't we give it some Lasix and we can both get out of here, okay? And you know what? Take them up on it, because if you let them do that, in a half an hour, the horse will have urinated, they can cut their sample and they'll be out of there. But that's how little it affects our testing nowadays. So it's not a problem to do that. Lasix is a drug that we don't allow in our group of horses. It would be in the forbidden category, so 24 hours withdrawal. It's obviously used in race horses, but it has no inherent advantage in a sport horse. So drugs that might affect performance, forbidden drugs, and this is a whole group of them. These are grouped by category and then some specific drug. Additional forbidden ones, corticosteroids other than dexamethasone. We talked about that. We'll talk about how you deal with that. And then the one category, anabolic steroids for Arabians. This is in their three-year-old halter and breeding classes. There was some concern a few years ago that dressage might have a similar problem in their young horses with anabolic steroids. Actually, the USEF drug program at that point tested a fairly large sample of those classes across the nation and found no positives. So I don't think there's a significant problem going on in young dressage horses, which is good. I mean, young horses don't need anabolic steroids. So how are we going to use them legitimately for therapy? Three requirements, okay? Legitimate therapeutic use, must withdraw for 24 hours afterwards, and must file a medication report form. So what's a legitimate therapeutic use? A diagnosis is needed here. And on the medication thing, there will be a diagnosis. And I keep saying this, one of my favorite slides, and it's in all my veterinary talks, is it says at the top in bold letters, absent a diagnosis. And then it says, medicine is poison, surgery is trauma, alternative therapy is witchcraft. Okay? And the point being that you need a diagnosis. And it's important for you as horse owners and riders to make sure that your horses don't get what has become somewhat popular in the show horse industry now is, well, I don't know, it doesn't look quite right. Why don't we just inject the hocks, fetlocks, coffins, and let's do the sacroiliac joint. And then that doesn't work, come back, and we'll use the left side of the truck. And you put a whole bunch of drugs in the horse, and you have no idea what the problem is. Okay? And that really needs to be resisted. Okay, every drug we're talking about here has a potential side effect. Okay, and we as caretakers of these horses should no more be letting people put drugs and medications in our horses for no legitimate therapeutic reason. We shouldn't be doing it. So that's up to you all to call the veterinarians on it. Okay? Okay, the question was, if there's a small cut that the horse can continue to compete with, and under USEF rules, the horse is examined by a treating veterinarian, the horse can be sutured up, and you can use lidocaine or carbocaine, no problem, but the horse must be withdrawn for 24 hours after that. Okay? And now, you will occasionally, and I've done this, like every other veterinarian who's treated horse show horses, everybody says, oh, I don't want to do that. And so you twitch the horse up, and you clean the wound up, and it looks like the old days when I used to cast horses with my dad. And it's a bit of a challenge to get it done. Now, here's the question. What if that's at an FEI competition? Ah, here's the interesting part about it. Actually, it's easier. FEI, what you do is you go to the treating veterinarian, you point the same thing out, the treating veterinarian then goes to the veterinary delegate and says, I need to treat this horse, and I need to suture it up. And you go get Form 1, which is emergency permission to medicate, okay? The veterinary delegate then clears it with the president of the grand jury. If the president of the grand jury clears it, you're okay to use carbocaine, you can do it, and there's no withdrawal. That's FEI rules. USEF is this 24-hour withdrawal. Okay? Okay, so if you're doing a legitimate therapeutic use of a forbidden substance, you're doing it for a diagnosis or a treatment, it's a management of existing illness or injury, and it must not be so severe that the horse shouldn't be able to compete. So if it's a huge wound, obviously the horse should not be competing, okay, or over a motion portion of a joint, that sort of thing. Okay, non-therapeutic uses. This is as important to understand as the therapeutic uses. This is clipping, shipping, stall rest, enforcing chemically stall rest, training, or enforcing calm turnout. None of those qualify as legitimate therapeutic uses. Okay? So, if you're going to do any of those, you have to do it in a time frame that the drug is going to be completely out of the horse's system, which we would call the withdrawal time. And your veterinarian should help you with what the withdrawal time on these substances are. And the other resource you have is Dr. Schumacher's office, because you can call their office. They give 24/7 advice on medication questions, and you can answer what the withdrawal time is on these various drugs that you're talking about. So it all depends. Whether if you got to clip your horse, okay, great. How do you do that? And we have... Locally, we have tons of people come by and say, hey, I need a shot to clip Tigger here. He's going to be bad. Tell me how much I need. I said, tell me when you're showing. Okay, great. Let's do the math. Okay, we're okay with this. Go clip your horse. And again, you know, it's very complicated to do this on your own. This is where you need your veterinarian to kind of engage and get involved. Okay, so you must withdraw for 24 hours, no exceptions under USEF rules. Okay, so you file the report, and that is prior to competing. As you're driving out the driveway and you remember you meant to do that, or your horse is being led off to be tested, that's a bad time to remember you meant to file the form. Bad time, okay, just so you know that. There's usually a fine involved with that. So our restricted group, let's just talk about how you can use them. Either one approved non-steroidal, and honestly, that's all I ever put my clients on. I never put them on more than one steroidal. None of these non-steroidals were ever intended to be used in combination. okay? And I don't like doing it. I think it complicates the complications, and I don't know what they're doing to the horse, and I think it causes some problems. So I use one non-steroidal. However, the rule allows for two non-steroidals approved for use together as long as you follow the dose and time recommendations. Butanbanamine, however, are prohibited to be used together. That's been that case since 1992. They're a very potent combination together, and that's not what we're looking for. We're not looking for potent cover up the pain. We're looking for low grade, enable the older schoolmaster to continue to get out there and do its job and not look stiff. That's what we're looking for. Not trying to cover things up. If you use them together, you may want to wait a minimum of 7 days to let those things clear out of the system. You use them together, they tend to compete for the same site in the horse, and so you've got to wait a little while to let them clear out of there. Other combinations, okay if they're approved non-steroidals and not more than two. Follow the dose and time recommendations. Okay, here's an example of the most commonly used one, bute. 2 grams, either orally or IV, not closer than 12 hours to competition, or the alternative that I recommend usually, 1 gram orally every 12 hours for a maximum 5 days. And that's my particular preference. And I do that usually as a paste, so I know the horse got it and that it's not sitting in the bucket for them to consume whenever they get around to it. Methocarbamol, again, this is for treating muscular back spasm. I don't find it very useful. For axial skeleton problems, there are better medications and treatments for backs. You know, shockwave, mesotherapy, Tildren, a variety of different things for backs that are really good, very excellent, cutting-edge things. Methocarbamol is as old as the hills, and for me, never did much, so I don't use it much. Dexamethasone or azium, 3 different routes. I'll run through them quickly with you. IV is 20 milligrams, 12 hours or more before competition. Alternative 2, a close-in treatment, 5 milligrams IV, 6 hours or more. And then usually if I'm sending people to Florida, this is what I tend to do, is we send them with 10 milligram packets of the granules for oral use to be removed 6 hours or more before competition. Primarily, we're treating skin problems with that. Okay, we talked about how would we use the corticosteroids other than dexamethasone, which is in our restricted category, and here's how you do it. If you're using depomedrol, okay, which is the generic for it is methylprednisolone, but everyone in the industry knows it as depomedrol. And that's what commonly gets injected in hocks. Okay? And it's the longer acting of all the corticosteroids that are commonly used commercially. If it's used for an interarticular injection within the 2 weeks preceding the show, file a medication report form. If it's Vetilog, triamcinolone, betamethasone, flumethasone, Flucort, any of those other corticosteroids, those are all shorter, then we're asking the client, when's your next horse show? Oh, okay, well, you're showing next weekend, huh? Okay, great. We just go get a medication report form off our file, and we fill it out, and we hand it to them. And then all they have to do is go turn it in. If you don't do that, and your veterinarian doesn't have those forms, which not all veterinarians will, then that's fine. Find out what the drug was, how much, how it was administered, what the diagnosis is, and you're all ready to fill the form out yourself when you get to the horse show. So that works fine too. What happens with a positive? Essentially, if it's an overage on bute, an average bute overage is about $750 penalty, administrative penalty, good rule of thumb, and you can just pay it and be done with it. Or you can go through a hearing process, hire a lawyer, you can test the B sample, which is sitting in our lab, And then by the time you get done with all that, you'll have $3,000 to $5,000 in it.
And we'll have the concluding segment in this series on next week's episode. Dr. Kent Allen will also be joining us again as part of the 2015 Adequan USDF Annual Convention's education lineup that takes place in Las Vegas, Nevada from December the 2nd through the 5th. And you can find out more about those educational sessions by visiting the website at usdf.org/convention. And whilst you're on the website, be sure to check out all the latest educational resources and information on eTrack at usdf.org. If you're listening to this episode online and prefer to listen to the show on the go, you can download it from the iTunes podcast store to any podcast app. And that's it for this week's episode. Thank you for listening wherever you are in the world. And remember, the USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.